Eric Engel from Sportsnet.ca covers the Montreal Canadiens on a day-in, day-out basis. And I know at times, Eric, that might be challenging, but here we are. It's never a dull moment in Montreal, as you well know. You document all of it. First of all, good afternoon. Thanks, as always, for stopping by. Before we get to some of the other Habs issues, whether it's, you know, Caulfield, whether it's Romanoff, let's start with Carey Price. What is the very latest? Do we have a timeline? Do we have an expectation date? What's happening with the goaltender?
Well, it's a little bit vague, but Dominic Ducharme said today that he expects Carey to be back in town soon. And the question directly asked to him this morning was, you know, we're approaching the 30-day mark. They had announced to us on October 7th that he was taking a minimum of 30 days within the Players Assistance Program. Marc Bergevin had said then that it could be longer than that. I think the one takeaway we have today is that it's likely not going to be longer than that. As far as when he specifically returns to the Canadiens, we'll see. And once he finally does, it's probably going to take him a couple of weeks to get back into game shape and be prepared to get into game. So, you know, like you said off the top, most important thing is on the human side here. If Carey Price is feeling good enough to return home, that's great. If he's feeling good enough to return to the Canadiens soon after, even better. And, you know, I hope for him and his family that everything is, you know, I don't know if everything is perfect for him. I don't think it's perfect for anybody in this world at any point, but, you know, that hopefully it's a lot better.
You know, I recall a lot of ovations in Montreal. The Rocket Richard ovation, probably number one. That just went on and on and on and on and on. It was one of the more glorious things I've ever seen in hockey. The Saku Koivu ovation, when he returned, was, you know, as a tearjerker, right? And that was such a special moment in the Montreal Canadiens' history. I can only imagine what Habs fans are going to do when Carey Price hits the net again.
I'm totally with you. And, you know, it's funny as you were kind of breaking that all down and I'm thinking about those moments. I also know how much it means to Price. You know, I go back a few years ago when he passed Jacques Plante on the game started list for Montreal Canadiens goaltenders, became the goaltender to start the most games for the Montreal Canadiens. He was in the midst of a terrible season with the Canadiens, and the fans had given it to him quite a bit. You know, the media had been relentless as usual. And I remember going to see him because, you know, obviously the game before that was a big story that he had tied Plante. And I remember, you know, that night, Paul Byron had scored his 20th goal for a second straight season, which was a great story. And I had already covered the story of Price tying Plante for the record. And he got a great ovation in the game that he passed him for that record. And they're at the Bell Center, I'm talking to Paul Byron, and scrum forms around Carey Price, and I'm pretty sure I'm going to write about Paul Byron that night. And as we start talking to Carey, you know, he's asked what that ovation meant to him. And he said, "I really needed that." And that really blew me back. You know, like I'm thinking like Carey Price, like Olympic goaltender, MVP of the league, this and that. Really, really needed to know that the fans really love him here and support him. You know, you know, he can put up a wall on the ice, off of it, certainly. But that was kind of a moment of vulnerability that always stuck with me. And, you know, if I expect that it's going to be a tremendous ovation when he does eventually take his net back, and if he really needs it when that time comes, I think that'll really be something.
You know, you can make the argument, Eric, that the two most difficult jobs in Canada are as follows. One, Prime Minister. Two, starting netminder for the Montreal Canadiens. And it takes a very unique type of person to be able to handle that stress and handle that pressure and be in there. And even just to say, you know, be as vulnerable as to say, "I need to take time off," or "I really needed that ovation." What is it about Carey Price? Like, we always talk about, you know, the it factor with people, like not, you know, necessarily how they play or what they do or the, you know, the minutia of the game itself, but there's a mental makeup. Some players can handle it. Some players don't. You've seen goaltenders come and go. Some could survive, some cave to the pressure. What is it about Carey Price?
You know, it's a great question and maybe the subject of a book later down the line, but I just think, you know, some of it's got to be, it's got to be very much like his talent, right? Like some of it's got to be genetics. Some of it's got to be the mind frame that he's built over all the years on the way up here. He's used to being in the spotlight. It's always been an interesting contrast in terms of the way he was raised, like a mountain kid in Anaheim Lake, very much in seclusion to the point where his father had to fly him to practices and games. You know, like it's, there's this incredible contrast of him being so much in the spotlight, but him coming from a place where he could, he's so secluded almost. So it's, and there's parallels too, right? You know, it's, you talk about it being one of the hardest jobs in Canada to be the goaltender of the Montreal Canadiens. It's often been referred to as the loneliest place in Canada. It's that crease. It's a fascinating kind of paradox. And I don't know what it is about Price and what's within him that enables him to block out everything that's going on in the outside and perform to the ability that he has over the years. We also know that it hasn't been possible for him at times. And, you know, you think back years ago before he put up this bubble around him with the media, when he talked about feeling like a hobbit in the hole in Montreal and not being able to do his groceries without the kind of attention that he might not crave at all times. And since then has been very careful about what he says, and creating that kind of bubble and protecting himself. But he really, and Brendan Gallagher spoke this after Price submitted to the NHLPA program, is he's really handled everything so exceptionally well and is such a role model. And it's almost unfair that he's got this air of invincibility to him, because we know that he's human. And so I don't know how much that changes now post this whole situation. And, you know, obviously, like everyone else, I'm eager to see what Price has to say. And if it's nothing, and if he doesn't want to talk about this any further when he comes back, I'm sure I won't be the only one to respect that. It's such a hard question to answer, Jeff. If I knew what made Carey Price and how he handles all that stuff, I really do think there'd be a good book in there.
So describe what Carey Price is coming back to. I mean, this is a team that's, you know, last place in the division, goal differential, -15. We all know it's been bad in Montreal. That's obvious. But what's he coming back to here?
He's coming back to a really different team. You know, that's what's been made clear over these 10 games, that, you know, we knew the Canadians would be affected by the loss of Weber, by Price going away at the beginning of the season, by Joel Edmondson not around to start, by Corey Perry with another team, by Philip Deneau not taking away that pressure out the middle, on guys like Suzuki and even Dvorak coming in and Kotkaniemi gone. But the DNA has been altered to a level that we couldn't have even expected, just because a lot of the core is still in place. And Jake Evans was talking the other day in Anaheim about how they're such a close-knit team. And it was so obvious last year, right? Like, they didn't have the type of star power that even Toronto had and getting past them in the first round, but they really did have a team that gelled together and came together and fought for each other, and we're all on the same page. And what we've talked about is the disconnectedness of the Canadians through the first 10 games. You know, you need glue in those situations, and I think of Carey Price as a glue guy. He's a guy that makes everyone feel better about themselves on the ice, and just his presence alone, no matter how long it takes for him to get back with the team and get back with the Canadians on the ice, it's going to help. How much is really up for debate, because they've dug themselves a hole that's exceptionally difficult to get out of.
You know, there are, as you mentioned, there's new faces here. You know, Hoffman, Dvorak, there are new players here. But I'm curious, because you watch and you're real close to all the games, all the practices, all of it. Who looks the most different from last season to this season? Is there anyone that you look at and you say, man, that's nowhere close to the guy we saw last year? Where'd that guy go?
I wouldn't say it's been the case for all 10 games, but there have been games where I'm looking at Jeff Petrie and saying he looks different. And I really don't think it's so much on the individual level so much as it is that on defense, you're depending on so many things for you to get your best game. And we're talking about a player that's had three straight seasons over 40 points, including one in just 56 games. You know, he's been unbelievable and getting better year over year in his 30s, which is an anomaly in this sport. maybe less so on defense, but he's just been incredible. So there's a level that you expect him to play at that's exceptionally high. I think the short summer was and turnaround is probably a factor in why he hasn't been at his best. You know, Nick Suzuki's another guy you look at. Like, I wouldn't have expected Suzuki to take a step backwards from where he was. I don't think if you looked around the league and pulled every executive, I think you'd have a really hard time finding one that would say that they didn't think it was a good deal that Montreal signed with Nick Suzuki before the season started. I think it was a really smart move that they made, and I think Nick Suzuki will compensate that over time and certainly quite quickly. He's putting a ton of pressure on himself to perform, and for whatever reason, the guys around him are not putting the puck in the net, and he's trying to do a bit too much as that's what tends to happen in these situations. So I look at those two guys and say they look pretty different through these 10 games. But I also look at them and say, you know, if the Canadians are going to pull off some sort of miraculous comeback and get their season back on the rails, which in my estimation really is about these next 10 games and getting themselves back to as close as 500 as possible. Because when Carey Price went away, my feeling was if they could be 500 by the time he gets back, they're okay. They're not in great shape. They're not in terrible shape, but they'll be okay. Right now, they're certainly not okay. So I look at Suzuki, I look at Petrie, and those are two guys that really need to lead them out of this. Gallagher's another one. You know, both Petrie and Gallagher, if they're both in tonight against Detroit, playing a little bit banged up. So, and we know that Gallagher just missed the last game in Anaheim. So, you know, it's a lot of pressure on these guys and a lot changing around them. And yeah, it's a good question. You made me think about it a bit, but you know, those are the two guys that come to mind. Obviously.
Okay, let me give you a tap in then. Your thoughts on Cole Caufield sent to AHL Laval, which I never think is a bad thing for a young hockey player. Ever. The story of this game outside of the superstars, the generational guys that go right from, you know, junior hockey or Division One right into the NHL and never spend a day in the minor leagues at all is rare. I don't know anyone that was harmed by staying in the American Hockey League, quote, too long, but I know plenty that didn't spend long enough there. Your thoughts on Caufield going to Laval?
Yeah, it's something Dominic Ducharme likes to say a bit. Well, the first thought is that I need to go back on something I wrote about a week ago where I was exceptionally wrong. You know, he had a really positive game in Montreal before the Canadiens left the road. He had really applied exactly what Ducharme was telling him to do, was to get his feet moving coming over the blue line, be a little less predictable. He had played his best hockey game in their first win of the season, and then they hit the road. And I don't know where it went, but just not – not being able to see the puck go in the net really hurt his confidence that much more, that he wasn't getting the fruit from his better labor. And I wrote this piece before they left saying, you know, he looks poised for a breakout now. Like something's changed and he looks better. And I think just not seeing that puck hit the back of the net really hurt him. So I'm wrong. I was wrong. Probably won't be the last time I'll be wrong, but that's part of the game. Sometimes you got to write a column, put your opinion out there. And that's what I did. And you know what? I really do think there's a couple of ways the Canadians could have gone with this. First of all, Laval doesn't play till Saturday. There was a couple more games for Caufield to potentially get some touches, get the puck going in the right direction, potentially the back of the net. But after watching him play against LA and Anaheim, you know, he was somewhat invisible, and it was clear the confidence was waning, and the confidence from the coaching staff was waning that this was the best place for him. And you could have either moved him up a line and put him back with Nick Suzuki, or you say, okay, well, it's time to take a step back. And I think that Laval might actually be the best place for him right now, not for the long term, for a couple weeks. Let him score some goals. Let him be around a team that's doing really well in the American Hockey League. Let him be around those good vibes and let him feel as though, you know, the game is coming back to him the way he's always played it. Because if you go through Cole Caufield's history, I don't know how many times you could pick out a 10-game segment where he doesn't have a goal, let alone more than 1 point. So, you know, it's something new to him, and I'd like to see the smile return to his face on a regular basis and see him be happy in the American League, scoring some goals, and come back up with that type of confidence, because there's no doubt in my mind he's an NHL player, and he already is one, and he proved that last year.
One thing I want to make clear between you and me, Eric, right now, I thought I was wrong once, but I was mistaken. Secondly, Cole Caufield, the American Hockey League is that sort of finishing school, for lack of a better term, for the NHL. I remember Dave Andrews, former president and CEO of the league, would talk about, you know, this is where a lot of guys come to learn, you know, to play defense. And I always remember something that Brian Burke told me about players. He said, you know, if you're a player, generally there's one thing you really excel at. But if that thing isn't working, what can you do for the team? Like, what if your A game isn't working that game, what's your B game? What can you do? And so I can understand the frustration if Cole Caufield hasn't, you know, made a red light, you know, turn on in 10 games. Albeit, you know, the history of goal scorers is they're all streaky. But, you know, that has to be frustrating to a kid who's always enjoyed that success. And I wonder if a stint in the American Hockey League helps you discover a B game. And I wonder, like, okay, what could a B game be for Cole Caufield? Like, if you're going to go through a stretch where you're not feeling it, you're not finding it, what could a B game be for Cole Caufield, do you think?
I think it's just about creating opportunities, right? Like, he's a better playmaker than people give him credit for. He's not just a goal scorer, but, you know, it's an interesting way of looking at it because you look at all the tweeners, right? You look at all the guys who... I'd rather have Caufield's problem than the other problem. You know what I mean? Like, if you have that one thing that defines who you are as a player, that, in a lot of respects, is better than having... doing everything somewhat well, but not having one specific thing you can do. We've seen a lot of players kind of fall victim to that. Guys that you look at that are explosive in the American Hockey League, and then there isn't a chair for them in the NHL to play that specific role. You know what I mean, Jeff? Like,
oh yeah. Oh,
I think of a guy like Charles Hudon, like, or even Adam Brooks, who's in the Canadiens lineup and couldn't make it with Toronto, right? Like, Adam Brooks was pigeonholed as a fourth-line center in Toronto where, you know, his skill set was more as an offensive guy, and if he's going to have to compete against a grit guy for that role, he's probably going to lose out. And then he goes to the American League and he puts up numbers, and you're wondering when he's going to get his opportunity. He's clearly the best player there. Like, same type of thing.
Yeah, the history of hockey is littered with those guys, whether it's, you know... Brett Sterling is one that comes to mind. Eric Westrom, Kirby Law, like these type of guys that go and they light it up in the American Hockey League, but the only chance they can get to come up and play with the big squad is in a bottom six and usually a fourth line capacity, and that game's not there. And then they get shuffled back to the American League where they go about lighting the league on fire. It's that to me has always been, Eric, just as an aside here, as we bid you good afternoon, that to me has always been one of the most frustrating spots in hockey, that AHL NHL tweener where you're too good for the American League but not quite there with that skill set at the NHL level. That to me has to be endlessly frustrating, Eric.
It definitely does, but you know, there's the flip side of it too, and tonight's a good example. Alex Belzil and Michael Pezzetta are up with the Canadiens right now.
Yep.
And Michael Pezzetta is a guy at 23 years old. You would have looked at him and said, this guy, like, he's never going to play in the NHL, and he's going to
make a gamer, man. He's a gamer, Eric. Total gamer.
The reason he's here is because the energy that he displayed in training camp, his willingness to get into a fight, to throw hits on every shift, whether it's a preseason game or a postseason game, whatever, he was going all out, and he started off and took that confidence to Laval and put up numbers that he's never really put up before. So the Canadiens could definitely use that energy. I think of Alex Belzil, who made his NHL debut at 29 years old, Jeff. Like, he's a great story, and this guy works so exceptionally hard. And so those guys know exactly what's expected of them coming up here to play that fourth line role, and they're gonna fill it.
We'll see. Tonight, the Montreal Canadiens facing off against the Detroit Red Wings, one of nine on the board this evening. Up against it, Eric, always full value. Thanks, as always, for stopping by. Much appreciated, pal.
Thanks, Jeff. Take care.
There is Eric Engels from Sportsnet.ca covering the Montreal Canadiens. They face the Wings tonight. Mo Sider, by the way, the NHL's Rookie of the Month in October. I know we've talked a lot on this program about how good Moritz Sider is for the Detroit Red Wings. To say nothing of Lucas Raymond. Sider's name you're going to hear for a long time in the NHL. This kid's just starting out and already to make the argument he's Detroit's best defenseman. Coming up in hour two, Sarah Sivian talks about the Carolina Hurricanes. Up next, Katie Strang. More on Chicago next. Welcome back to the program. America's Show continues. Sarah Sivian, bottom of the hour from The Athletic. More on the Carolina Hurricanes, who can seemingly do no wrong this season. Last team standing, a perfect 8-0. They're playing real good hockey, folks. That's a really good hockey team. And that is, you know, even despite losing Ducky Hamilton. Oh, man, that's a good squad. Look forward to talking to Sarah, as I always do. In the meantime, also from The Athletic, investigative reporter, our good friend Katie Strang. Katie, how are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm well. Geez, I don't even know where to begin. There is a lot. I know the one thing that, you know what, here's where I want to begin. I mentioned this in the first hour as I'm reading the information on Aaron Scaldi. And the filing of a civil suit will come up a little bit later on this afternoon. This is something that you and I have discussed offline. One term that I'm really uncomfortable using is the term alleged. Just because it's such a loaded word, and it's one that almost implies a lie. I always find. I guess I'm maybe looking for advice, looking for direction. Is there anything else that you would recommend overusing the term or word alleged?
Yes. In fact, there is sort of like this seminal piece regarding like language and using sort of the appropriate words and characterizations when talking about, you know, gendered violence, sexual violence. So Diana Moskovitz for Deadspin wrote a piece called Against Allegedly, and it goes into exactly what you said about sort of how loaded it is, how fraught it has become, the type of almost pejorative that it connotes. And so it talks about, like, you know, how it's basically like laziness to say like allegations and alleged. And I will be very clear, like I try to avoid it whenever possible, but I still do, you know, resort to it in sort of like a worst case scenario. On Twitter, it's really hard just because you have to be pretty succinct and it can be hard to avoid. But what I try to do, like when I write about a quote unquote, like what would traditionally be called an allegation or something like that, is I try to like just really dumb it down and get a bit more plain with language. So when you say, instead of saying like, you know, the woman's allegations or, you know, Kyle Beach's allegations, like you try to say what this woman said happened to him. So there was a couple times in a piece that I think I wrote about Kyle Beach recently where I referred to it as what Kyle Beach reported had happened to him, had told people happened to him. So, you know, same thing with accused or accuser. I always say, like, you know, the woman or the man who say this happened to him or who say that this person did this to him. So I think that's like a good rule of thumb just in terms of the way we talk about these things. It can be practically difficult to avoid in some cases. And, you know, when you're going through a very extensive legal review in written form, sometimes it's a necessary evil, but you know, there are ways to try to avoid it if you can. And for anyone that has not read that piece by Diana, like I refer back to it probably six times a year.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, Deadspin no longer exists, but that does, right? Is it dead?
Yeah.
Is it? Well, no, was it Deadspin?
Defector. Now it's Defector. It was Deadspin at the time. Diana now works for Defector. She's wonderful. Like I highly recommend reading anything that she writes. It's all appointment reading, but that piece is particularly instructive, I think, to young journalists and to seasoned journalists alike, and anyone really.
I was going to say to anybody, not just journalists. You know, I was having a conversation with someone this morning about the Kyle Beach story and what's happening and how so much of the framing seems to be about how things have changed and everyone is different and wouldn't happen now. And this friend of mine said to me, I really don't like it, and I concur with this person. Like, I really don't like it. It makes me uncomfortable because it almost suggests that now, 11 years later, we have a new way of looking at crime. Crime was crime 11 years ago. Crime is a crime today. And what we're looking at is a crime. Through that lens, how do you see the way we're looking at 2011? And I know the word "we" is doing a lot of work there. I mean, everybody, but perhaps maybe the Blackhawks, the NHL, the way they're looking at what happened in 2011. How do you interpret, how do you see the way that they are looking at these events?
I think they are reacting to public pressure. I don't think they're acting out of, from a place of necessarily like empathy or reflection or accountability. I think they're responding to public pressure. I mean, let's be honest here. We would not be having these conversations. We would not have seen the Kyle Beach interview. We would not have seen the Jenner and Block investigation had it not been for the doggedness and relentlessness of Rick Westhead. That's it. Mm-hmm. And I think I do think it's really dangerous to assume that we've just like turned a corner, you know, because yes, we might be more, you know, willing to talk about this more openly and write about it more openly. But I mean, I think we're still seeing terrific failures in the way that it's being talked about and handled. And I mean, Gary Bettman's press conference, case in point, you know, utterly devoid of any level of empathy. I mean, you know, I listened to you and Elliot's podcast a few hours ago. Like, Elliot just right off the top saying, like, I thought I lacked empathy. He's saying, like, well, I probably can't say this on the radio, but, you know, swearing and say it was offensive, which I think a lot of us felt. And to me, that's illustrative of the fact that within the reaches of power, maybe not much has changed.
Well, see, I looked at it a couple of different ways, and I felt the exact same way that you did. And then I caught myself and I said, well, hold on a second here. These are two lawyers that are holding this press conference, and, you know, their jobs. Like, I was always reminded about this. I was reminded about this years ago, and it always stuck with me. Remember, the number one job for the commissioner and deputy commissioner of the NHL is franchise values, protect the franchises. They are employees of all the owners of these teams. And I thought to myself, you know, we're looking for empathy, and instead we got legalese.
But let me push back on that. They don't have to be mutually exclusive. Like, you can be a shrewd legal mind and also have human empathy. And let me go a step further. Like, if, like you say, which is entirely correct, that Gary Bettman and Bill Daly work at the behest of the owners, and it behooves them to do what is right to bolster franchise values and stability for the league, then what I would argue and put forth is that ensuring safe and healthy work environments is helpful in toward both of those aims. In fact, it is essential to, you know, move forward those aims. I mean, if you want to build an infrastructure of robust and healthy member clubs, you have to ensure like positive, safe work environments. Like, this is actually good business practice too. I understand that they're businessmen. I understand that they're lawyers. But the reality is, handling this the correct way helps mitigate some actual legal liability and is also good business practice. Doing the right thing, like, does not have to be mutually exclusive if you're a good businessman or a good lawyer, or a good, you know, businesswoman, or a good compliance officer. You can do all those things.
My point there was that from an, because, you know, we talk about the two different courts, and, you know, the main one right here, right now, is the court of public opinion. The language that they use and the way they deliver a message is very lawyerly, because that's the way they've always done it. Like, I don't know if we're expecting too much out of people that have only communicated. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. And as a matter of fact, in this situation, it is wrong, and they need something else.
Yeah. And so then I think sort of the next iteration of that conversation is, then shouldn't we expect more? I mean,
absolutely,
you're right.
We should.
Like, you're absolutely right. Like, if we're operating under the assumption that, like, you know, when someone shows you who they are, believe them the first time, like, that's absolutely right. Like, we should have expected what we saw yesterday. But I also think there's the argument to be made, like, shouldn't we expect better of our leaders? Which is, if you are incapable of delivering, you know, a message without, you know, human empathy, then you're not fit to be in that position. You are not fit to be a steward of this league, no matter how much money you make, you know, all the owners. I mean, isn't that what we should expect? I mean, isn't that what, like, players and fans deserve?
Mm-hmm.
As someone that can do both?
Absolutely. And I think that this is very uncomfortable because they've never really had to do it before for the commissioner and deputy commissioner. Again, I want to make perfectly clear, I'm not excusing them at all. I think the default here should be empathy.
People not knowing
saying,
our relationship probably thinks this is adversarial, but just you and me just like breaking bread
My my only point is, I don't know what we were expecting out of Gary Bettman and Bill Daly,
if somehow they would be
completely different than as we've always known them, because, you know, that way of talking, behaving, communicating, all of it, that's always got them through their day, and that's what's led them to their position. But I think you do wink at something here right now. This seems like a pivotal moment right now for the history of the NHL, and I don't think I'm being hyperbolic when I mention that. Like, it really feels like we're at a moment right now, whether it's at the NHL club level, whether it's at the NHL proper level, that this is a moment that's going to determine the direction of this league for the next however many years. Like, does it not feel like we're at that moment right now?
It does, from a cultural and, like, sort of like a public disenfranchisement with the powers that be within the NHL. So it does from that perspective. But I also don't want to be, like, so Pollyannish to think that, like, you know, just because people feel aggrieved by the lack of humanity shown in a press conference, that things are going to change. Because I think ultimately, and I hate to sound like cynical or like a skeptic, but I think it ultimately comes down to the bottom line. So who, like, you know, the power is so centralized within the NHL, and there's really, like, not a ton of oversight. So who is going to hold, you know, the commissioner of the NHL accountable if he, you know, delivers a message in as sort of disappointing and deeply troubling way as he did yesterday? I mean, it's got to be either the owners or sponsors bailing on the league, or, you know, fans putting enough pressure on their respective owners or on sponsors to turn the heat up on that sort of, you know, delivery, I guess.
There's a there's a number of questions that are still left unanswered out there. I've got a few that I've been over on this show on the podcast as well. What's still unanswered for you, Katie?
Oh boy, I've got a lot of questions. So one of the things that I found frustrating about yesterday is this idea that, like, you know, we saw the NHL memo, which was not just encouraging, you know, club and league personnel to come forward if they saw any inappropriate misconduct, but requiring people to do so. I think that's good. Like, I think empowering and emboldening individual agency is smart. I think empowering bystanders is smart. But you can't do that without, like, a level of, you know, pretty robust protections built in. And I did ask Bill Daly about this, you know, when I was reviewing some of the NHL hotline stuff. And there is a section on the NHL hotline's website where it sort of, like, vaguely references whistleblower protections. And Bill confirmed that there are some, but they're not super specific. It's pretty ambiguous. So, for example, I don't know what happens or what sort of protection the league is able to provide at someone if, say, they are blowing the whistle on a superior's conduct, someone that's right in their chain of command that might control their livelihood. I don't know what sort of whistleblower protections are provided if someone is bound by a non-disparagement or a confidentiality agreement as part of their standard employment contract. So these are some of the, like, probably more granular details that are sort of fascinating to me. But I do think, like, you know, the details are important when you think about wide-scale cultural and systemic change, which is mm-hmm. needed.
There's, like, I'm with you. Like, the dynamic, and listen, with Chicago, and you all know this, like, John McDonough ruled that team with an iron fist. You know, he was a very imposing, intimidating person, and it was very top-down. John's going to take care of all of this. John does it. This is John's squad. Everything is very managed by John McDonough. I was having a conversation with someone last night who talked about, you know, if this league is going to take the next step and if it's going to appeal to the next generation of fans who want things like transparency, which is a big one, and believe in justice, social justice specifically, that the top-down model in this person's mind doesn't work for the NHL, and it has to be more of a bottom-up model. Do you agree with that?
I think I would have to know what that even, like, what does that even look like and mean? I mean, in theory, yes, it sounds great but I'm largely basing that on the fact that it is top-down model right now and I don't feel like it's working. So, you know, I do think I give credit to anyone that, you know, advances efforts to actually finding solutions, because I do mm-hmm. think that's, like, sort of missing from the equation right now. And I love what you said about Sheldon Kennedy on the podcast, just about how he's so relentlessly, like, optimistic, and he always is, like, trudging forward despite all of the times he gets betrayed and let down. But he's, you know, fighting for those sort of systemic structural changes.
Yeah.
So, you know, I guess I'd put that question back to you. Like, what do you think a more bottom up model even looks like?
I think what this person I was talking to is talking more about is releasing power. And I know that's a very difficult concept for people, but more power to people that were quote unquote underneath. Like, I don't think it's a very casual conversation. It was a comment. I remember, like, you know, I should probably ask Katie about this because Katie's smart, and Katie will pick up on it right away. But you're like the top down.
I clearly didn't.
Well, the top. Listen, what we can all agree on right now, this top down model isn't working. And I think what we think, you know, the next generation of business, certainly in North America, isn't going to have this, you know, it'll be a different style of leadership. It'll be a different style of setup. I'm not sure what it is going to look like. I just know that this style isn't working. And I think a lot of us feel that way. And to the point about Sheldon Kennedy, first of all, that guy is a treasure. And you were great. You and Allison were fan. Allison Forsyth on Hockey Night in Canada on Saturday with Ron, I thought were tremendous. And I'm always impressed at someone who's been, oh geez, how should I say it? I mean, betrayed, I think is the right word. I mean, lied to. We always say it can never happen again. Sheldon, what happened to you? We can never stand for it. And yet here we are again and again and again and again. And he doesn't get, I mean, I'm sure he gets frustrated, but he's still in there fighting. Like, to me, he's one of the more important figures out there in this.
Absolutely.
In this battle for decency. In this battle for decency, like, who out of all of this, and there's probably a couple of people that come to mind for you, and certainly Rick Westhead, who's been at the forefront of all mm-hmm. of it, who impresses you through all of this? Kyle beats us.
I mean,
impresses
Rick West,
everybody. That's
Kyle beats
strength.
First and foremost. I mean, just strength, vulnerability, courage, character, humanity. Like, I mean, Kyle, that interview on Wednesday was a total game changer. Like, people will be talking about that decades from now. I'll remember how I felt seeing him apologize to that young man in Michigan for as long as I live. You know?
That was a tough one. That was the moment for me, Katie, where I was like, okay.
I think it was a moment for a lot of people. And you know why? Because for all of this, and for all of the, like, just utter failures and inaction, you know, conspicuously absent in a lot of the sort of reckoning was just like a simple apology. You know, it's not, I think people, I know that lawyers are loath to admit culpability and that they want to avoid that at all costs. But I think what lawyers like sometimes forget, it is the non-monetary items that I think actually mean the most to victims and survivors, even if they're engaged in civil litigation. I think apologies and safeguards and pledges for transparency that have real meaning and force behind them, those mean a lot. But when people dig in and like word salad their way around accountability and don't just say, hey, you know what? I screwed up. I'm sorry. You know, like it's people are willing to give a little bit when they hear that, because there's a level of authenticity and reflection and genuineness about that. And so we've been missing all of that. And I think we've seen it from Kyle Beach, but we've just like really missed that from a lot of the principals in this story.
You know, when we look at the outpouring of support that Kyle Beach has received and the outpouring of love, and people gravitate towards love, when you look at what's happened around Kyle Beach, since, you know, the Reed Schar report, since the interview with Rick Westhead, since he, you know, outed himself publicly and said this, I'm the person in the Reed Schar report. That's me. When you look at the outpouring of support around him, many have pointed out that would encourage other people who were victims to feel stronger about standing up and saying, you know what, I was a victim as well. I think we all expect that to happen. And historically, and listen, you've covered plenty of stories like this. Historically, is that the case? And do you expect that to happen in this situation as well?
I can tell you it already has. And I'll give you sort of a personal anecdote. There's a story that like I've been working on, you know, for the past couple of years. It involves a sexually abusive hockey coach in the Chicago area. And I've run like maybe a 7 or 8 part investigative series about, you know, all the ways in which he, you know, has preyed on young hockey players and gotten away with it throughout the years and been sort of like shuttled from organization to organization, et cetera. Those victims have come together to file a federal lawsuit and such. So the wheels of justice are turning, right? And I had someone reach out to me the day after Kyle Beach's interview. And, you know, without getting into specifics here, because I can't really report on the specifics yet, but someone came forward with some very critical new information to that case. And he basically said, you know, I've been sitting on this for 30 years, and just watching that interview made me feel like I couldn't do that in good conscience anymore. And I don't know whether it'll have like a material difference in the case or not. But it certainly is critical new information that I can say is being considered at this very moment. And I'm hopeful that it will have a real impact.
What do you think next is next here, Katie? Like all of us are sort of wondering, okay, like today, you know, at the beginning of the negotiations between the Chicago Blackhawks and Kyle Beach. And the one thing that's become pretty apparent is the Beach camp is going to make all of this public. They want this all out in the open. I'm sure Chicago would like to NDA it up and let's keep this, you know, let's keep this within the room. And the Beach camp wants no part of that. But what do you expect to happen next year? Or is the, I mean, listen, the answer might just be my answer, which is I have no clue. You know, I this thing is going to, I think, spiral off into a lot of different directions that none of us can even foresee. But then you cover these types of cases a lot closer than I do, or Elliot does. What do you see happening here?
I see them settling with Kyle Beach, and I see them doing so because I don't think they want to risk this going to discovery. Mm-hmm. I see the same thing happening with the young man in Michigan, and I believe that, you know, I believe that will happen. I think we will learn about more of these situations that have happened, either are happening right now or have happened in the past, that have either been, you know, looked into to varying degrees of rigorousness or not. But I think people are starting to identify that the system is broken and is not working to serve, you know, people that have endured harm, and not working to serve people, protecting people from harm. And so I think people saw Kyle Beach's real leap of faith, if we're being honest, coming on a national broadcast to talk about that with so much, like, you know, poise, and, you know, he's so articulate, and so much like complexity and nuance. I think that's going to be hopefully like a guidepost for others, that, you know, I sure hope that Kyle Beach feels like a level of catharsis from doing that. I hope this outpouring of support provides him some level of, you know, validation and healing. But, you know, healing, I don't think for survivors is a very linear process. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, the echo of trauma is really unpredictable. And even when you're being overwhelmed with positive support, it's overwhelming. And, you know, I can guarantee you Kyle Beach is going to have a ton of people reach out to him, and they're going to disclose things to him, and he might be super grateful for that. But that's going to be hard to hear. And, you know, so I think I see Kyle Beach certainly being part of any potential solution. I don't think he would have done that Wednesday if he wasn't, you know, committed to leading the way on that. And I mean, he doesn't have to look much further than Sheldon Kennedy wrote, like what that looks like. But I don't, beyond that, I don't know. I think there, sometimes things have to feel a lot worse before they get better. And I think sometimes things have to sort of unravel to really reveal, you know, what's rotten, you know, about institutions. And I think we're going to see that continue to unspool.
Last one, and I know you'll want to keep, you know, the focus on people like Kyle Beach, for example, but how do you handle this? Like, this is what you do for a living.
And
Katie, I fail to believe that it doesn't dent your soul at times, take a piece out of you. How do you do it?
Yeah.
Because I'll be honest.
Does.
I don't know how you, honestly, I say this as a compliment. I don't know how you do it. I don't.
Yeah. It's hard. I'm not going to lie. Like, you know, I definitely eat my feelings and have too many glasses of red wine occasionally. And I may or may not be suffering from stress-related hair loss right now and dealing with a lot of that right now. But I mean, here's the thing. What always like propels me to do this work is, you know, it is hard and emotionally taxing, but I always think about like how much infinitely harder it is for people who are sharing their traumas and risking quite a bit personally to come forward. And it is always animated by the fact that they want to make sure others don't go through it. People assume that it's like people with axes to grind or people that are disgruntled. It's never that. That's just not a good enough reason to come forward. People always like come forward in my mind out of concern and regard for others. And that's like, you know, at its basis, at its core, like, this is a very depressing, dispiriting subject. But that's a really uplifting, affirming thing for me, that for every two people who act, you know, in sort of like the, you know, institutional protectionist in them, and that, you know, serve to cover their own hides, there's always like one person willing to stick their neck out and speak up because they think it's the right thing to do. And that's it. So that always like keeps me going. That fills my cup.
You're a good person, Katie Strang. I don't know if enough people tell you this, Katie Strang.
I also eat a lot of cream sauce pasta. I eat a lot of cream sauce pasta to eat my feelings.
Listen, whatever gets you through the day, it's what you do is very difficult and very emotionally taxing. My whole career just said like, hey, that's offside or that's a bad pass and we'll be right back. Like, seriously, Katie, like you're a really good person doing seriously good work. Unfortunately, we're out of time because I could do this all day with you, and we'll just carry this conversation on to our next phone call when I'm walking my dog and you're going through the drive-through, and I know exactly what you're eating, Katie Strang, and don't pretend that hasn't happened.
Thank you for not judging me about what I ordered at 10 a.m. yesterday morning.
It'll be our little secret, Katie. Don't worry. You be well, my friend, and continued great work. You're a real treasure. Thanks so much for this.
All right, of course.
Katie Strang from the Athletic, a whole lot there. She is such an important and impressive person, and I do say that legitimately. I don't know how she does it, going to work every day and opening up a nerve and listening to these stories and all day long, like dogged pursuit on behalf of victims. She's an impressive person, and I encourage all of you to read her work. It is tremendous, and it's not just hockey as well. All right, thanks to Katie Strang for stopping by. Pause and then reset, and we're going to come back and shift gears and actually talk about hockey on the ice, and that is the Carolina Hurricanes. And listen, Freddie Anderson has been outstanding, third star of the month in the NHL. Save percentage of .956. The Hurricanes are a thing, are a force, and are undefeated. Sarah Sivian stops by, who covers the Carolina Hurricanes, comments on the Canes in a couple of moments as the Merrick Show continues across the Sportsnet Radio Network. Welcome back to the program. I want to thank Katie Strang from The Athletic for stopping by. Sorry, the great Katie Strang from The Athletic for stopping by. From the great Katie, we go to the great Sarah Sivian, who 2 hours ago, perfect time to have Sarah Sivian on, who 2 hours ago at The Athletic published 8 reasons the Hurricanes are 8-0. So first of all, Sarah, good afternoon. Thanks so much for joining me here on the show today. Second of all, why are the Hurricanes 8-0?
Well, thanks for calling me out for not finishing my article last night, but they are 8-0. I would start with the number 3 star of the month, Freddie Anderson. He has made all the saves he's had to make and some he hasn't had to make, and then you get into depth, and then you get into even strength and special teams, a little bit of everything.
First of all, good afternoon, Sarah. It's so good to hear your voice again and catch up. You know, Anderson's, you know, I live just a little bit north of Toronto, and it's a team that I watch a ton. And, you know, Freddie Anderson had always been a sort of lightning rod in Toronto. Some praising, some slamming, can he get it done in the playoffs? Like all those things that I'm sure that everybody's heard about Freddie Anderson. He's been great. 956 save percentage, perfect record so far. What have you like, listen, cause you're not just someone that, you know, splashes a record, on the pages of her piece. Like you talk a lot about, you know, the human beings here as well. I know it's early in Freddie Anderson's career in Carolina and you're early in covering Freddie Anderson, but is there anything that stands out about Freddie Anderson that catches Sarah Sivian's curiosity?
Well, it's amusing in a good way. I feel like as stoic a person as he is in net. Like, I was trying to get some, I try to make them laugh sometimes. I'm trying to make them laugh. He will not crack a smile, but I respect that. And I asked him today just kind of what has played a role into the success. Like, is it anything to do with the fact that you're kind of away from the spotlight here in Carolina and you're just kind of like more separated and you have a fresh start other than like being with the Maple Leafs for a while and their whole situation? And he just said he's playing behind a really good team. And I feel like there's a lot of goalies that come to Carolina and it's like, whoa, how did this happen? Like all of a sudden he's really good. And it's like, they have a really good defense. So I feel like goalies appreciate that.
You know, we were laughing the other week as the Maple Leafs were going, now they've won two in a row, so everything's fine in Toronto, and they're checking bridges to make sure the floats will fit underneath come next June. But, you know, we were joking as the Maple Leafs were going through this. Yeah, this was actually leading up to the Carolina game. We're trying to figure out, you know, which ex-Maple Leaf player is enjoying this losing streak the most for the Maple Leafs. Is it, you know, Zach Hyman? Is it Kasperi Kapanen? And I think a lot of us turned to each other and said, you know what? It's Freddie Anderson. And I know he'll never say it publicly, but do you get a sense? And I don't know how much money was on the board there a couple weeks ago with the Maple Leafs loss to the Carolina Hurricanes. Mm-hmm. But do you think that somewhere in the back of Freddie Anderson's mind is, yeah, you know what? I'm really enjoying watching the Maple Leafs struggle here.
As long as Austin Matthews is scoring, right? I saw he allowed Matthews to goal in that game. So I'm like, as long as he has that, he doesn't strike me as a spiteful person at all, but I do think he got a lot of unfair criticism and some fair criticism, and then just things kind of seem to fall apart on both ends there. And I mean, he seems more of a person that kind of enjoys his own success here than is kind of waiting for the Maple Leafs to fail. And I feel like he likes a lot of his teammates on that team. But if you just look at maybe some of like the media, I'm sure that he is happy that it's kind of like, oh, so he wasn't the problem, right? It's like kind of vindication.
I think that's fair. I think that's completely fair because he was, listen, I'm sure he didn't like, you know, not being the goaltender of record when the Toronto Maple Leafs ended up, you know, losing to the Montreal Canadiens. Yeah. In his mind, he's the starter, and turning that to Jack Campbell, I'm sure couldn't have been fun for him. Yeah. You know, what one thing, Sarah, I wonder about the Carolina Hurricanes. Elliot and I talked about this on our podcast. You know, at what point will they just finally admit it's personal between them and the Montreal Canadiens? Now, I will tell you this. I think it's fantastic, and it's a great way to build a rivalry. And, you know, there's some hot sauce in the chili on this one. There's some spice to the rivalry on the ice, off the ice. It's a digital feud as much as it is one on the ice, to say nothing of the boardrooms with offer sheets, etc. But we're all just waiting for Carolina to finally admit that this one is personal. This is Tom Dundon. Like, this is Dundon versus the Habs.
I was going to say, well, who do you think
Tom Dundon
needs to say that? Because I feel like the social team admits that it's an off-ice personal thing. Tom Dundon might never admit that, but his actions speak way louder than his words. Like, you aren't – I mean, Kotkaniemi has worked out amazingly so far. I mean, amazingly is probably dramatic, really well so far in Carolina, but – $6.1 million, there has to be something personal in that, especially when you know he kind of – lowball Dougie Hamilton. It's kind of like he's willing to spend that much on one player. Let's look at the history and context. And then you're like, oh, that offer sheet from years ago.
See, the Kotkaniemi thing to me is fascinating because to me it sort of it points to a new way to do offer sheets. Mm-hmm. Although it's not really, because we've seen you know the 1 year offer sheet before, but this 1 year mega offer sheet. Only to, and we all expect this in January, and Sarah, I'm sure you're in this camp as well, see a new contract for Jesperi Kotkaniemi emerge in January when they could finally offer him an extension. But the one year offer sheet, just to get the player out of where he's playing, and then, you know, the wink wink, we have a contract in the drawer here waiting for you come January. To me, it's quite clever. Like, if you're going to try to get a player out, you know, don't do the 4-year contract where the AAV gets flattened, et cetera. Maybe it's heavily bonus. You try to, you know, leverage that, and how much is you going to want to spiff a huge check to start. To me, this might point at the way to do offer sheets. If you want to do it, make it a 1-year whopper with an understanding that there'll be another contract come January.
Yeah, it's clever, but it's a little bit risky because that player can kind of take that 2-0 and run with it somewhere else if they really want to. So I feel like there has to be kind of an element of that player was unhappy where they previously were enough to kind of do that handshake deal in the first place. And I think that really worked out with the Hurricanes. You kind of have to be sure that the player will take maybe a lesser deal when the time comes. And I feel like the $6.1 million is pretty stocked up. So that's kind of front loaded there. And I feel like they had to kind of get to know the player before anything was seriously signed there.
So I have your latest piece in front of me right now. As I talk to you, I'm curious about one thing here. I'll read this back to you. You can share this with our listeners. Every time the officials penalize Andrei Svechnikov with a soft call, it seems like he then gets an empty net.
Yeah, he racks up the empty netters. He is not afraid to do that, and he does not care what anybody says about him. But I do, and I talk about this with Rod Brind'Amour a lot, and like, because he's very open about his opinions on the refs, and we agree that there's a lot. Svechnikov plays in such a unique way that I'm not going to say he's as good as Gordie Howe, but I'm going to put that comparison out there with the way he charges to the net, and I feel like a lot of refs maybe just haven't seen that from an actual scorer in a while, or I don't. It's like a different hybrid of a power forward type situation, and he takes pretty irresponsible stick infractions at sometimes, and that's on him. But I feel like the refs are just 10 times harder on him, and he gets a lot of interference calls that aren't really interference, if you ask me.
You know, I look at Svechnikov, Sarah, and I say to myself, you know, this guy has all the potential to be one of the best left wingers in the game. Loaded with skill, really strong. Like, I remember we used to always joke, you know, let's see the birth certificate here when he was in Barry. I remember at the combine, you know, doing the interview with him in Buffalo, and we left, and, you know, Brian Burke turned to me and he said, "You're going to tell me that guy is really 17 years old?" Like, he's just always looked like, I mean, he was 25 playing in Barry. Look, like he was 25. Look, like he was 17 playing in Barry. Looks like he was 25 years old. Like, he's always been like a really big, strong guy and loaded with skill, great feet, great hands, really creative. Like, you look at players in two states, actual and potential. To me, he's still in potential. I don't know how good the actual can be, but I know the ceiling looks really high. What do you think of Svechnikov?
I feel like the sky's the limit for him, and it's because of his work ethic. It's but like, he grew up in kind of an interesting, he was poor, him and his brother Evgeny, who actually just signed an NHL contract after a little weirdness with the Red Wings there, and now he's on the Jets. But they grew up, nothing was handed to them, and their parents sacrificed everything so they could play hockey growing up, and they ate from the same plate, like that kind of situation, and they both work so hard, they never complain, they show up, and it's funny because Andre can do the lacrosse goals and things like that, but he also is just the least cocky, most humble person in the world, and for that, and the way that resonates with Rod Brind'Amour, and they work together so much, I feel like as long as they have each other, kind of the sky's limit for this team and Andre.
What can you tell us about Rod Brind'Amour? I know you talk to him often. You write about him often as well. You know, he went through an interesting situation where it became really obvious that he wasn't going to get market value for what he was worth on the open market. Like, this guy goes to the New York Rangers. We all know this guy is making top dollar in the NHL. Yeah. That became an obvious one. Wanted to take care of everybody around him, wanted to make sure that everyone was paid. Loves where he lives, you know, loves the organization, all of it. And, you know, to his financial detriment, I'm sure his accountant had other feelings on what he should settle for. You know, he settled for a number that was well below market value based on someone who's at the level of coaching that Rod Brind'Amour is at. Share your thoughts about Rod Brind'Amour. What do you think of him?
It's such a unique situation and it's hard to fully describe, but I'd say, and I don't want to speak for him, but I'd say he doesn't really actually love coaching, and he won't coach anywhere else because he loves the Canes and he loves being a part of this hockey community and kind of keeping it together here. But he's as good as he is at coaching. He doesn't he doesn't love it. I don't think he wants to do this forever. I think he wants to retire after he's done with the Hurricanes. And the money has never been an issue for him. And I don't think that's fair. I feel like he deserves to make more money. And that I think they should have paid him more. I just feel like he deserved it. But he did have the leverage. He has more leverage when he doesn't make more money to kind of take care of everybody else. And that's kind of what he made sure he did, obviously. So
yeah.
It's an interesting situation that the Canes are capitalizing on for, is that morally sound? I don't know, but that's what they're doing.
So the answer to this question used to be Jacob Slavin. But I think now most people, even if you're a casual observer of the game, you know the name. And you probably know how good he is as far as being a defensive defenseman, which, although, you know, he's got 6 points so far on the season, is almost a point a game guy. But I'll ask you this one. And I wonder if maybe the answer is Martin Natchez. I don't want to pressure or bias the jury here, but I'll throw that name out there. Who is the most underrated player on the Carolina Hurricanes, or perhaps better phrased, for all the hockey hipsters out there? Who's the ultimate hipster player on this team? Used to be Slavin. Hey, man, you don't know about Jacob Slavin? Man, you got to pay attention to the Carolina Hurricanes here. Who's that guy now? Because Slavin can't be a hipster anymore. Everybody knows his name and knows who he is. Who's the new hockey hipster in Carolina?
And here's the thing with that. I always say, like, if you don't know who these good guys are on this team, then it's, like, kind of on you for not paying attention to good hockey teams, because this team has made the playoffs 3 years in a row. But I don't know if I'd call this hipster because he did win a Stanley Cup back in the day, but Teuvo Teravainen, I just don't know if people understand how truly versatile and good he is. He's great at defense. He has a great shot when he chooses to use it. He calms Aho down. He's one of the best passers I've ever witnessed. Just day in and day out, he'll have like multi-point games so many times. And I feel like he flies under the radar, but he keeps the team together. He really does.
And he was a gift from Chicago. He was a flat-out gift for taking the Bickle contract, helping Stan Bowman out of his tricky salary cap situation. That was there have been a lot of nice things the Carolina Hurricanes have done with their cap space to get players, and Teravainen's clearly one of them. Sarah, this has been a delight. Always good catching up and sharing your expertise with the Carolina Hurricanes. Very much appreciated. Listen, man, they're on a fun run. Like, enjoy it, as I'm sure you are, and continued success. And we'll check back regular. Thanks so much for doing this.
Anytime, Jeff. Thanks so much. See ya.
There she is, Sarah Sivian from The Athletic, covering the Carolina Hurricanes. There's a lot of, like, I love Svechnikov. I just think this guy is fantastic. And I know they own $7.7 million. I'm good with that. 21 years old. I'm good with that. 7 goals in 8 games, 11 points. I got no problem with that whatsoever. Sebastian Aho, one of the elites in the NHL down the middle. And I'm glad she mentioned Teravainen as well. And, you know, there are times when Rod Brindamore puts that line together with Aho, Teravainen, and Svechnikov. And when they're given long runs together, with all due respect to, you know, Colorado and Boston, you know, that's one of the best, maybe at times the best line in the NHL, full stop. Before we get going, Matt Marchese, our producer, haven't heard from you for a while. How you been, bud?
I'm good. Well, I mean, all things being considered with everything that's going on.
Yeah.
All right.
From the people that contribute to the conversation by way of Twitter, has anything in the scant minute and a half that we have left here, anything stand out for you?
Yeah, there's a couple. One about the Montreal Canadiens. I missed the Montreal Canadiens from May 27th to June 24th, 2021. That from Teapot to Foley. And one more. This is my favorite. From Carter. Cole Caulfield, Sebastian Aho, and Teravainen about to look real good in a few years.
Montreal, that is so true. Montreal, by the way, in action tonight against the Detroit Red Wings. Red Wings are fun, man. Red Wings are a fun team to watch all of a sudden. Sider's the rookie of the month. Lucas Raymond's a lot of fun to watch. That's going to be a really good squad. I know Montreal is going through it right now, but Carey Price is on the horizon. Thanks so much for joining me today. Much appreciated. The latest 32 Thoughts podcast is out right now as well. For anyone listening to this show on podcast, we thank you for the downloads. We're back tomorrow for more of the Jeff Merrick Show across the Sportsnet Radio Network.